You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. About a sixth of the Earth's land surface qualifies as desert today, and if climatologists' predictions hold true, much more will be subject to desertification in the future. My guest today spent the better part of 4 years traveling to seven of the world's most inhospitable, remote, and formidable landscapes. Despite the harshness, William Atkins found plenty of activity, both in nature and from people who are attracted to the solitude and terrain of the world's deserts. In his book, The Immeasurable World, Journey in Desert Places, he travels to Oman's Empty Quarter, Australia's Great Victoria Desert, where Britain tested their nuclear weapons in the 1950s, to the Sonoran Desert along the U.S.-Mexico border, where migrants tempt death in an attempt to enter America's economy, to the dry Aral Sea in Kazakhstan, a desert of man's own making, the Black Rock Desert in Nevada, home to the Burning Man Festival, the Gobi Desert in China, home of exiles of the past and present, and the Eastern Desert of Egypt, home to oppressed Coptic Christian monasteries. Along the way, he combines both history, past and recent, with his own travelogue. Fascinating story. William Atkins is a contributor to The Guardian and Granta, and the author of a previous book about a beautiful but daunting landscape, The Moor, A Journey into the English Wilderness. His latest book, The Immeasurable World, Journeys in Desert Places, is published by Doubleday. William Atkins, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The stories you tell in The Immeasurable World are by turn heart-rending, sublime, and once in a while, occasionally ridiculous. These stories about these incredibly empty places that you surveyed. What led to your interest in learning more about these large, empty places that most of us stay away from, the deserts?
Well, I mean, there are two main triggers for this book. One is simply in language, and that word desert that I think particularly in Europe, particularly in Britain, is so heavily freighted with symbolism and metaphor. And I really wanted to understand what it was to have the desert under my feet, as it were, coming from this kind of green, generally speaking, very wet land in Europe. Deserts are mysterious places to me and to a lot of my country folk, I think. And so it's about stripping away all that kind of symbolic baggage and trying to understand what the real desert is. So that's on the one hand. And the second is in biography. I spent some time a few years ago staying with a community of Cistercian monks on the edge of Dartmoor in southwest England. And in the course of that stay, I spent some time in their ancient library and began to understand the connection between Cistercian and Benedictine monastic communities that exist in Europe and America, all around the world, and the desert. So the first Christian monastics really were the so-called desert fathers in the second and third century. And these were men and women, they were desert mothers as well, who fled the cities, Alexandria of Egypt, and went to the desert in search of God. And so on the one hand, I was interested in, yes, the word desert and understanding more clearly what that word meant. But also I was interested in the relationship between landscape, geography, and a particular kind of a religious practice.
This whole idea of going to the edges of the earth, if you will, and for solitude, for, I guess, almost the simple structure of surviving in a harsh climate that leads to, I guess, a closeness with your creator?
Well, one of the questions I ask in this book is what has drawn us historically to these very, very difficult places, going right back to the second and third century, and indeed to biblical times. What is it that appeals to us about these extraordinarily difficult places? There is a term used, an ancient Greek term, used by the desert fathers in second, third century, these forebears of today's monks, and it's panaremos. And panaremos means the centermost desert, the innermost desert, the most deserted part of the desert. And there's a corresponding term used by French travelers in the Sahara in the 19th century, désert absolu. And again, it's this absolute desert. It's the center of the desert. And so I think very often that kind of mythical end of the rainbow destination is what desert explorers and those like myself who have been drawn to the desert have been seeking. And in that sense, it's a kind of spiritual quest. But of course, there are other reasons that take us to these places.
One of the things you remind us in your first chapter, when you went to the Empty Quarter in Oman, is that Englishmen have long been drawn to the desert. You know, T.E. Lawrence, all sorts of explorers in the late 19th century, they were almost drawn like moths to a flame by this idea. And I think it's beyond just mere exploration or, you know, sort of superhuman achievement of crossing the uncrossable, you know, what many of these lands were referred to. There's something more primal involved. What do you think it is?
I agree. I think one of the great modern books about deserts is called Scenes in America Deserted by Rona Banham, who was a British art historian, architectural historian. And this is a cultural history of the desert, particularly in America. And he says in that book that the Protestant mind's eye may be vanquished by the desert without incurring the moral penalties of aestheticism. It's rather a mouthful, but it's always stuck with me, that quote, because it seems very true of those individuals you've just referred to, people like T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, Wilfred Thesiger, Bertram Thomas, who I mention in that chapter. And so you're right. My instinct is that there is something about those landscapes, about those very harsh, arid, stripped back, marginal landscapes that echoes something in the makeup of those individuals, those usually men, and usually or very often British men, who were drawn to desert places. So I think you can think of particularly someone like T.E. Lawrence, but also to a lesser extent Wilfred Thesiger in the Empty Quarter and the Arabian Peninsula, as people who found themselves, for one reason or another, at the margins of British society, who didn't feel at home in Britain. And I think there's an argument to be made that they recognize something of their own spirit in those difficult, harsh, marginal landscapes.
What about yourself? You know, your last book was about the Moors, about the English Fenlands. You know, at first glance, there could be nothing further from the Moors than, say, the Great Victorian Desert or the Gobi Desert or the Sonoran Desert or the Eastern Desert of Egypt that you explored in the course of writing this book. What was the attraction for you? Was there any connections?
It's interesting. You're right that at first glance, there is no obvious link between this very, very wet upland landscape, the moors of England, and the, by definition, arid landscapes of the deserts that you've just listed. And yet, this desert book did emerge from that earlier book. Moorland is largely unpopulated. It's treeless. It's flat. And I mentioned the Cistercian monastery earlier on the edge of Dartmoor in the southwest of England. And very often, Cistercian Benedictine monasteries were established on the edge of places like moorland or fenland, difficult, harsh places, because those places represented a kind of counterpart to the deserts that were familiar to the desert fathers, those early monks in the second and third century in Egypt. And so there is a kind of, in my mind at least, there's a link between these two apparently very different places, different kinds of landscape. As for what draws me to deserts and indeed to moorland, I think that's a question I sought to answer in the book. And I think rather than answering it, I probably just elaborated on it. I think probably, like some of the earlier British explorers of desert places, and I'm certainly not an explorer, but I think like them, I recognize something in myself in those landscapes. And I think particularly because they're such unfamiliar landscapes to us in Britain and indeed in Europe, because they're so sparse, apparently so sparse, and so bereft of life, it seems, certainly when you first enter a desert. And compare that to the kind of abundance and richness of the British landscape, albeit it's not necessarily a natural landscape. And I think there's that appeal simply in the novelty of places that are so unfamiliar to a European.
Well, the first, as you mentioned, the first place you went was the Empty Quarter in Oman, which, again, is this huge desert that, again, British explorers were trying to figure if there's a way they could get across it. And you've sort of retraced those steps. What did you learn in retracing some of their steps?
Well, I mean, I retraced in a very modest way, a small part of the journey of Bertram Thomas, who was less famous than Wilfred Thesiger, who's notorious for his crossings of the Empty Quarter, but was in fact the first European, at least, to cross the Empty Quarter. And although I suppose I approach these individuals with a certain degree of scepticism, partly for the very reason that you've just described, which is that there's sometimes an absence of self-analysis. And so we look very often at these extraordinary journeys as simply kind of colonial adventures, whereas I think there's very often a kind of biographical element that we're not always conscious of. But as to what I learned, I think despite any scepticism I might have had about those individuals' motives, it was really extraordinary admiration for what they had done to themselves by entering into this very, very harsh landscape and coming very close to death. And so I suppose a question at the heart of the book is, why did they do this to themselves? Why did they undertake these very, very dangerous journeys in these extremely difficult, challenging, dangerous places?
When you went to the Empty Quarter and you said, I want to go into the Empty Quarter, I want to go into this area, what was the reaction of the people that ended up guiding you? Were they like, why do you want to do this?
I think that was the reaction of Bertram Thomas's guides. I mean, yeah. I thought he was insane because, I mean, there is a certain amount of water in the Empty Quarter, but not very much, and one wouldn't enter it unless one absolutely had to. But, I mean, my guides, they were accustomed to taking outsiders into the desert. And I think also, I mean, that they were Bedouin guys who now lived in Salalah in the city. And it was a great joy for them, I think, to re-enter the desert that really was their ancestral home. And so they, I think, had some understanding of what the appeal was. And they'd certainly taken various other eccentric Brits into the desert in the past.
Well, one of the most interesting stories you tell in it is the Great Victoria Desert in South Australia. Very sad story, and yet you met this amazing eccentric character, Robin, who, how would you describe him? He's sort of the caretaker for the British.
I'd say caretaker, yeah. I mean, Robin is extraordinary, and he was my guide during the weeks I spent in that part of Australia, in Maralinga. Maralinga is the site where the British tested their nuclear bombs in the 1950s and 60s, with, of course, the agreement of the Australian government, and partly because they were no longer able to draw on nuclear intelligence from their American allies. And so while America's tests continued in New Mexico and Nevada, Britain began testing a series of six nuclear bombs in the deserts of South Australia. And for me, the story is interesting in several ways, partly because it's simply not very well known that Britain tested nuclear bombs in Australia, certainly in the UK, but also because it marks up two very different approaches to understanding the desert landscape. And so on the one hand, you have Europeans, British explorers in the early days of Australia's foundation, and indeed the Australian authorities themselves, who saw these places as voids, as places without value, without meaning, without a population, where you could do whatever you want, a kind of hiding place for official dirty work, if you like. And yet, of course, this landscape had a population, an indigenous population, the Anangu people who had been crossing the plain where these nuclear tests were to take place for perhaps 50,000 years. But this population was thrown off their ancestral land. The land was contaminated pretty much permanently, although a certain amount of work has been done to clean up the contamination. And so, yes, it's that distinction between what we as outsiders might view as a place where there is nothing, where there is no value and no meaning and no significance, next to the extraordinarily deep significance that such a landscape holds for the indigenous people.
And still to this day, there are indigenous people that cross through this site that Robin is in charge of sort of corralling. And you tell a story of one family, the Milpuddy family. Tell us a little bit about that.
The Milpuddies, there are, I believe, still descendants of the Milpuddies. But the Milpuddies were a family who, in the immediate aftermath, an Anangu indigenous family, who in the immediate aftermath of one of the nuclear tests were picked up by a British patrol on the edge of a vast crater that had been left by a nuclear device after it had been tested. And they had been cooking in the bottom of the crater out of the wind. And they were scooped up. Their dogs were shot dead in front of them. They were scooped up, relocated to somewhere they'd never been before. There were various health implications in the years that followed among the Milpides and their children who were with them. And there's a sense, I think, that some of those injuries, as it were, continue to this day. And the implications for the wider Anangu community, the Pitjantjatjara people who live in around Maralinga, you can still, I think, detect the injury that was done to that community and its long-lasting legacy.
Yeah, it goes back to the point that not only was this land completely barren and there were people there when they did the tests.
Well, I mean, that certainly seems to be the case. I mean, anecdotally, that I heard a lot of people saying that it's almost certain that there would have been people crossing that area. It's a vast, vast area, and it would be impossible to completely police it and ensure that nobody entered it during these tests. So, yeah, there are people who say that many people would have been succumbed to radiation poisoning, or indeed to the blasts themselves. Although that's not recorded anywhere, but I certainly heard those stories. But I think in a way, the more tangible damage of those events is that the land for the indigenous community, it seems to me, is permanently destroyed. And that those Anangu people I spoke to were very reluctant to go anywhere near this place. I mean, they consider it in a sense cursed, because they recognize that it's a dangerous place, that there are still places there where nobody can enter because of the intensity of the radiation contamination. And so this land that is so integral to the faith of the community has been stolen, has been taken away forever. And so that seems like a crime, a terrible crime to me. And interestingly, as I say, one that is relatively little known in the UK, and I would say probably outside of Australia.
Right. My guest today is William Atkins. He is a writer and author of The Moors, about the English Fenlands. His latest book is titled The Immeasurable World, Journeys in Desert Places. It's published by Doubleday, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He traveled to 6 major desert areas around the world, actually 7 if you count the Black Rock Desert, where Burning Man takes place. And he's written about his experiences there and a lot of the history of the location. And again, contrasting this horrible tragedy in Australia, you have this character, Robin, who is the caretaker of this nuclear site. Here's a man who doesn't need to be there, doesn't have to be there, yet is strangely attracted to it. And the same way he's also attracted to the sea.
Yeah, he and his wife, they exist between these two poles. So Maralinga is about 200 miles north of the Great Australian Bight, which is where the coast is. And yes, I mean, he'll spend a month at Maralinga in this deserted, abandoned British military village, which overlooks the bomb sites. And then he'll have a hankering for the sea, and he and his wife will travel out to Ceduna, where they have a home, and go fishing, and then after a few weeks, they'll have a hankering for the desert again. And so they live between these two places. Robin, it should be mentioned, is a former shark fisherman, and so he's somebody who's fairly accustomed to living with a certain degree of peril, I think.
And yet, I found him interesting because, for one, he's the one person that sort of prefers to live in some of these harsh environments, which really he doesn't have to. Yet he's strangely attracted to it.
Yeah, and I mean, his wife is an Anangu woman, and I imagine for her there is a kind of ancestral connection to the land. But for him too, there is a love of that place, a love of the indigenous communities that live nearby and among whom he's worked for most of his life. I think he likes the freedom. I think he likes the solitude. And a lot of the stories that I tell in this book about the desert as a kind of place of liberty, a place where we can be as we wish to be, away from the kind of constraints and the mores of the conventional urban society, and so we can act as we act as we wish, whether that's good or bad. Yes, so I would say Robin is a man who enjoys his liberties.
Of course, on that latter point, you visited the Burning Man in the Black Rock Desert in western Nevada, and certainly that goes, but strangely, you found it, you know, I sense that you really didn't enjoy the festival and didn't enjoy this idea of going into the desert. It sort of counteracted your feeling about desert. Would that be a fair statement?
That's perceptive, yeah. I mean, it's outside my comfort zone in a way, in fact, to a greater extent, in fact, than any other place that I went during the course of researching this book. I mean, firstly, the Black Rock Desert is a very, very harsh, environmentally very harsh place. Burning Man, which is this vast festival of 70,000 people that congregates on the Black Rock Desert Playa at the end of August, takes place on this ancient lake bed. So it's very, very dusty for a start. It's quite windy. It's very hot. And it's also just very, very demanding. There's continuous, endless music, for instance. There's a lot of noise, a lot of chaos. A lot of joy. I mean, it's an extraordinary phenomenon, and there were elements of it I absolutely loved and which took my breath away. But I often felt a kind of hankering for peace. I'm somebody who likes a certain amount of solitude, as you might gather, and you're, in a sense, trapped within the boundaries of Burning Man, Black Rock City. And if you try and walk out into the desert to obtain some peace, some quiet, you find that your way is blocked by Bureau of Land Management agents, by representatives of Burning Man, who are stationed around the perimeter to prevent people going out into the desert and, frankly, dying. And so, for me, there was this tension between the excitement and chaos of Burning Man.
I think you referred to it as one hand, it was
and
like
then the tranquility of the desert on the other hand.
I think you referred to it as them watching over a group of toddlers.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of that. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Burning Man is that there's no or relatively little crime, certainly almost no violent crime. I mean, it's quite heavily policed by undercover police, and relatively few serious injuries. I mean, given the harshness of the place, given that there's, you know, dozens and dozens of fire-breathing mechanical devices all over the place, and given the state, frankly, of most of the people who are there, it's remarkable that there aren't more injuries and indeed deaths. So it's, and I sound perhaps sort of skeptical about it, but I hope one of the things that comes across in that chapter is also how much I at times loved being there and how much I admired Burning Man as a phenomenon. It's a really extraordinary thing.
It's also, you know, having spent so much time in other deserts, and as we follow your journey, so many of these journeys are about conservation of your materials. And this seems like an utter 21st century experience in which, you know, the only reason people are there is because of our 21st century conveniences, fossil fuels that get us there, that keep us safe, that, you know, that help us get through that whole festival. And there's something in Congress about that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting tensions for me about Burning Man is that throughout history, deserts have been places, with the exception of people perhaps like the Desert Fathers, but generally speaking, they've been places that people have sought to cross as quickly as possible or to avoid entirely. And yet, Burning Man is an instance where 70,000-odd people go for a week into this very, very harsh landscape. And in a way, that brings this back to that idea of places, landscapes that offer a certain opportunity for liberties that aren't necessarily available to us in our everyday life. And the setting for Burning Man is absolutely integral to what it is. I mean, it simply couldn't, although there have been attempts to kind of replicate it around the world, it simply couldn't exist in quite the same way, I don't think, in a different kind of place, because it's a blank canvas. The Playa is this kind of enormous white sheet on which, for 1 week every year, this extraordinary thing happens. And so, yes, the setting, the desert, is absolutely fundamental to what that event is.
This is interesting because this whole chapter is very different from the rest of the chapters. You spend time in the Sonoran Desert where you're detailing the efforts of groups like No More Deaths that are trying to help people who are crossing the desert from Mexico keep from dying in the desert as they try to make their way in the United States. You're also telling about a horrible ecological disaster area in Kazakhstan where the Aral Sea has disappeared, the Aral Kalm. And, you know, there's some really interesting stories in this book, The Immeasurable World, with my guest today, William Atkins. Before we leave, you know, a sixth of the Earth qualifies as desert today. And I was just recently seeing a story and a map published in New Scientist, which predicts what the world will look like with a 4 degree centigrade increase in temperature. And what was really fascinating was most of the continental United States will only be fit for solar generation. Even southern Europe will be that same situation. Northern Canada, Antarctica will be the places where it's thought that people will be habituating and living in you know, northern Scandinavia. What's your thought about the idea of this, you know, the desert? It seems to be encroaching more and more landmass as time goes on.
Phenomenon of desertification, as they call it, has, I think, been on the minds of environmentalists and ecologists for some years now. And one of the things that became very apparent to me in the course of researching this book is that there's a difference between a desertified place and a desert, a natural desert. For all the sparsity of somewhere like the Empty Quarter, it's a living place, and you're very conscious of it as a kind of, in a sense, a thriving place, even if it's not necessarily biodiverse. You wake up in the morning and the sand around you is covered in footprints. And so you have a place like the Empty Quarter on the one hand, and then somewhere perhaps like the Aral Kum, the dry lake bed of the Aral Sea, or indeed those nuclear test grounds in the deserts of Australia or Nevada or New Mexico. And they feel, or in my experience at least, feel like dead places, and truly dead places, truly deserts in the old-fashioned sense of the word, meaning simply deserted, abandoned, lifeless places. And so, yes, and I think those places can be warnings. Certainly I experienced the Aral Sea, this vast body of water that was drained to feed the Soviet Union's thirst for cotton, as a warning about ecological improvidence.
True. You know, it's amazing seeing seaside villages miles and miles and miles away from the actual coast of the Aral, what remains of the Aral Sea. It's poignant.
It's a frightening place.
Yeah. The name of the book is The Immeasurable World. William Atkins, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
William Atkins is the author of The Immeasurable World, Journey in Desert Places. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.